Boag World is brought to you by headscape.co.uk in association with getsignoff.com. In this week's show, we review TextMate and the top 5 tips for web designers, and we discuss the plight of in-house designers.
Hi Paul, how are you doing?
Hi Paul, how are you?
Hello Paul.
Hi Paul.
Hi Paul and Marcus.
Hello and welcome to the first ever BoagWorld.com podcast.
Boag World.
Hello and welcome to the 100th episode of Boag World.
And welcome to the 123rd episode of BoagWorld.com, the podcast for all those involved in designing, developing and running websites on a daily basis. My name's Paul Boag.
Just jump
right in then.
And my name's Ronnie Barker.
Ronnie Barker.
No one will know who that is outside of the UK.
And outside, over a certain age as well. That's the other problem, of course. So, are you going to do all your apologies, or do I need to apologise on your behalf?
Well, I'll apologise for the audio quality last week. Hopefully this week it's considerably better, although you might hear lots of shuffly noises because I've adjusted things. I spent more than 10 seconds on it, so let's hope it's more up to scratch.
But we're drawing a line in the sand now, right? We have made our ultimate effort and spent far more time on doing this week than we have before. We are not going to spend more time on this issue.
We've spent a whole minute on it this
week. And we're not spending any more than a minute. So no writing in. We don't want any advice. We don't want any criticism. This is what you're going to get.
About anything.
Anything. Or advice. Yes.
No advice. No criticism, and we'll be happy.
Yes.
And Paul, so if Paul, you don't you need like to apologise, don't you?
I don't. What am I apologising for now?
You need to apologise about the fact that you broke my router.
I did not break your router. So we apologise for the fact that there is no live show this week.
Because you broke my router.
I did not break your router. I simply tried to get on the internet and your router couldn't cope with two laptops at the same time.
Like it always has done before.
Well,
broke my router. And we're going to finish this podcast. You're going to go, bye.
Yeah.
Go home, carry on doing what you think. And I haven't got any internet connection ever again.
Well, there we go. What can I say?
So that's why you need to apologise.
What can I say? A, you've got a crappy old router that can't cope with more than one laptop. B, you live in the back of beyond, so I couldn't even use my 3G card here.
I live in the back
and
of beyond.
And C,
I live in the back
of
beyond.
I get 3G signal in Blandford, in Dorset.
That's because you happen to live right in the middle of Blandford.
It's very convenient, I admit.
It's true, though. But how can you possibly say this is the back of beyond?
And C, I barely get an O2 signal here in order to be able to text Twitter to tell people that it's not going to happen.
Yeah, that's true.
So all in all, crap place.
Yeah, we're around my house today.
Yes, we ought to say that.
Because normally we're at the office in Southampton.
But basically, Marcus is just too busy. I can't remember. Oh, and now I've got to pick up my child and things like that. So it's all very complicated. I guess people are really interested in this kind of thing. We ought to talk more about our personal lives and problems because they don't want to know about web design. They want to know about our lives.
Yeah. Our really dull, boring lives.
So with that, shall we get on with the news?
That's probably not a bad idea.
Boagworld.com.
My first news story, I have to confess, fills me with fear and trepidation because whenever I mention this subject on the show, I get a torrent of emails educating me.
He had his fingers waving.
Yes.
Educating.
Into the fact that that even mentioning it is evil. And that is the subject of HTML emails.
Oh, they're great. I get loads of those.
They're much nicer than those boring plain text ones, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah.
They're so well designed and attractive. So I am a little afraid of mentioning it, but there is a story that's come up, or a couple of things that have come up that I want to mention. I have to say, personally, not a great fan of HTML email, and wished it had never been invented, and it seems to have led to a plethora of problems. However, I am realistic, and I do accept that it is here to stay. And despite its many drawbacks and its many problems, from, you know, on the basis of cold hard facts, from a marketing perspective, HTML email is more effective than plain text. So, count odds it, really.
Who says?
Stats.
Mr. Stats. Okay.
You
don't know, do you? You're just making that up.
No, not off the top of my head. No, I don't have a photographic memory. But I
read once in 1998.
If I had my computer in front of me, I could prove it to you. But I'd need to look it up on the internet, and we know how that's going to go.
Yeah, you broke it.
Exactly. Yeah. No, you broke it. Someone broke it. Anyway, so I think we're going to be hard-pushed to persuade our clients to forego HTML and email. So inevitably, sooner or later, we're going to have to produce some HTML templates for email, just occasionally. If we can get out of it, great, but if not, then fair enough. Of course, being the conscientious web designers that we are, we want to produce nice HTML emails that look great and are well-coded. So this leads to the couple of stories that I wanted to mention for today. The first is that Patrick McNeil of Design Meltdown, do you remember Design Meltdown? We've mentioned it before on the show, has launched a new site called Spam Meltdown. Now, although it's
sounds
quite...
like cooking of some sorts.
Melting Spam.
Melting Spam.
Nice. Although it's not the best title, to be honest, because none of the sites he showcases actually are, or not sites... any of the emails he showcases, none of them are spam. They're all opt-in, so they're not really spam at all. But anyway, that's right. What he's called it, because it's quite an amusing title. So the site showcases great examples of email design in the same way as Design Meltdown showcases websites.
Okay.
And Patrick has done an amazing job, and he has my sympathy, because I was talking to him about this, and he subscribed to well over 1,000 mailing lists. Can you imagine? He gets like 150 emails a day from this lot.
No, horrid.
Yes, I know. So he's done pretty much the same as he did for Design Meltdown, and the various HTML emails are organised via style, colour, industry and topic. And as with Design Meltdown, this categorisation approach works really well, because you might have in your head, for example, I've got to create an HTML email for a travel company. Mm-hmm. So you can go in and you can look at all the other travel HTML emails around and, you know, be inspired in what you're doing. And equally, you might decide, well, I really want to do something that is, you know, has got a dark background, for example. So you can go in and look at all the ones that have got dark backgrounds. So very useful, much better than the normal kind of, site showcase where you just go through page after page after page. So the second kind of news item, as well as the launch of Spam Meltdown, which you can look up via our show notes, is the fact that Campaign Monitor have updated their chart for CSS support for email clients. Now, if you haven't come across Campaign Monitor before, it's a service that enables you to send HTML newsletters. But they are very kind of conscientious, giving to the community type of people, and they do a lot more than just take your money in order to get this service. And they put out a lot of information about HTML emails and compatibility, a lot of education work and that kind of stuff. And they're actually heavily involved in the email standards project, which is like the web standards project, but for email.
Okay.
So next time you're trying to produce an HTML email template, check out their CSS support grid, as it clearly shows you what particular CSS properties are supported in which email clients. Very useful indeed if you want to try and do it with nice code and not just give up and use tables and font tags, which I have the habit of doing when it comes to HTML email, I have to confess. So there we go. While we're on the subject of cool services like Campaign Monitor, I also wanted to mention Clicktail. Do you remember me mentioning this before?
I do remember, a long time ago.
This got quite a strong reaction, Clicktail, because Clicktail basically allows
you... Big brother.
Yeah, there was a feeling that it was very intrusive and it invaded people's privacy. Because basically what it does is it enables you to watch users move around your site in real time and record that and use it for all kinds of different purposes. Now, some people felt that was intrusive.
And send them disturbing messages while they're doing
it. No, that's a different thing. That's Woopra
yes.
That does that. Now, this, you literally just record them.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all anonymous and everything, but I don't know. I mean, I don't have a real problem with it, really. I kind of see it as a valuable tool for learning about user interactions and how to improve your site's usability and that kind of stuff. But fair enough. Anyway, if you share my view that this isn't a deeply disturbing and intrusive thing to do, then you may be interested in a new service that they've started offering, which is all the more intrusive. And
right.
No, it's not. It's great. So you can not only now click users as track users as they click around your website, you could also watch them as they interact with forms. So in addition to video recording, the new
can you make their camera work on their laptop so don't
you can
know
see them.
Exactly look
how
at
cool
them.
Would that be? Now that would be a step too far because it wouldn't be anonymous.
Sure?
Then yes, it would.
I don't know who they are though, do you?
I've got a line in my own head about what's fine and what's not, and that's not. So in addition to video recording, the new form analytics service provides three valuable reports, right?
Mm-hmm.
So one, a time report, which shows you how long a user has spent completing each field, not the form in its entirety, but each field.
Mm.
A blank report, which provides you information on fields that have been left blank when they submit it. And a refill report, which are basically fields that have been rejected and they've had to fill them in again. So it really gets an idea of problems that users are encountering with their form application. So if you run a site that requires users to complete long or complex forms, then this will be really beneficial to you. Also, if you've got a high traffic e-commerce site, then it could literally be invaluable, you know, because it will substantially reduce the number of users dropping out at checkout, which is a big problem on e-commerce sites. So really good.
I think that's very good indeed.
I quite like that idea that you just had.
What?
We could do that as our next web app.
Oh, what?
An analytics tool that actually records people and audio as well, so you can hear them swearing and ranting.
Yeah.
Like Silverback, the Clear Left product, but without people's permission.
Yeah, far more
all
intrusive.
The better.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Excellent. They haven't gone far enough, those Clear Left guys, in my opinion. Anyway, next news story. So this week has seen the launch of Jason Santamaria's new personal website. So that, for those of you who don't know, including no doubt Marcus.
I know who he is. I know what he looks like.
I'm impressed. So he's the creative director at Happy Cog, which is Zeldman's company. I'm telling everyone else, not you, Marcus, because you already know.
I do know
you
that,
do know.
Yes.
So normally I wouldn't really mention the launch of somebody's personal website. It's not exactly breaking news, is it? But Jason has done something very interesting that I thought was worth mentioning. His new design is very well executed, but it's very plain, basically. It's certainly not as inspiring as some of his other work. Now, the reason for this really simple approach is that he's creating a framework on which he can build. And this is where it gets really interesting. The idea is that each of his blog posts will have a custom design associated with it, right? So the design will therefore reflect the content. In effect, he's bringing art direction to his blog. So this is, I think, a really bold experiment and something that Zeldman has written about before, that the web is lacking. You know, if you look at, say, a billboard ad or a newspaper magazine, that the visuals and the copy go very much hand in hand. There's not a situation like on the web where you create a kind of website look and feel and content's just blocked into these various, templates and that's it. Everything is tailored to work together. Very interesting idea. Now, I'm fully behind the idea of bringing content and design together. However, I do have a couple of reservations about this wonderful plan of Jason's. First, there is a possibility that constantly changing the designs could make navigation around the site confusing. Now, I have to say, I don't think that's going to be the case in Jason's scenario, because he's been really careful to ensure that key navigational elements remain in a consistent location and have a similar style, although he does, say, change the colours and stuff, wherever you are on the site. So I think he has addressed that. But I kind of, if other designers start adopting this, are they going to be so careful, you know, about that? And I think that's a great idea, but be careful about that.
Mm.
My second concern is a purely practical one. If each article not only needs writing, but also needs designing, will it reduce the amount that Jason posts? In other words, is a blog really the right place for this type of art direction where you're constantly putting content up? I think it's great for a site where the content doesn't change as often, but I'm not so sure whether it's a good idea for a blog. However, despite those reservations, I'm really pleased Jason's doing this. A personal site always used to be, God, I'm sounding old now, back in the day when I was a lad, you know, a personal site used to be a place where you'd experiment and try new things, but you don't see that as much these days. And too many blogs, including, to be honest, my own, is a kind of cookie-cutter solution with some pretty graphics slapped on top of it. And it's superb to see somebody trying something different. So props to Jason Santamaria.
I think it's a rubbish idea.
You're just being controversial now. Why do you think it's a rubbish idea?
No, that's too strong. I don't think it's a rubbish idea. I think it depends on what the content is. And I think I do actually think it's a fairly rubbish idea for a blog, because a blog is about the words. It's about the content. It's about the ideas, unless it's a blog about design.
But surely then, which it is, obviously.
Which is fine then.
But surely the design then could back up the content better if it's customised for the content.
All right. Looking at it from a different, taking Zeldman's idea about if you see billboard posters or television advertisements, then the design of that and the copy of that is married together. That's true, but take a book for example. They are usually white pages with black words on them.
Sure,
and it's. Web pages, particularly blogs, are somewhere in between the two.
Yeah.
So it's not that clear cut, in my view. It's all about the content. It depends what that content is, and the design should make it as easy to use as possible.
Yeah, I agree with that. But I think it's great that Jason is doing this, simply because it kind of, well, we're sitting here talking about it for a start, and I think it brings art direction to the fore as well.
Yeah.
And I think it's okay for his blog because his blog is design orientated and it is about design. And so I think there is a lot of options there. I think it's a really interesting experiment and I'm really glad he's doing it. So props to him for that.
Okay.
So my final news story for the week returns to the subject that I have touched on quite recently, actually, on the show, which is how do you do wireframes when you're using a modern web application with a high level of interaction? How do you demonstrate that through wireframes? And in show 120, I mentioned one approach which might be to utilise Flash in that process. However, today I want to point you at an article on the List Apart website which suggests that building prototypes might be a better idea than wireframing. All right, so quite a difference there, you know, because obviously wireframing is very static, prototypes are much more interactive. So, when I first saw this article, and probably as you're hearing it, I was really hesitant, right? Because my immediate reaction is I can barely persuade clients to pay for wireframing, let alone for a full-blown prototype of a website, right? That seems like a lot of work. However, the more I've considered it, the better an idea it seems, I have to say. So let me explain my logic of why I think it might be a good idea. So the majority of time you spend getting an application working, right, is with things like bug fixing, browser support, kind of not non-core functionality. That's what takes all the time. So a kind of rough outline of an application can come together actually very quickly and so therefore not be that expensive. What's more is that unlike wireframing, a prototype can be used as the basis for the final build. So it doesn't get thrown away like a wireframe would.
Yeah.
So I think actually it's quite an interesting idea. The article also points out that prototypes are better for demonstrating difficult concepts to clients, which are true. You know, you don't have to make such a kind of leap to understand what's going on. And they also encourage early collaboration between designers and developers, which is great in the sense that, you know, they kind of resolve those problems of where things overlap much quicker in the process. And they also provide something substantially better to use a test against. So with almost every new website that comes along these days having some form of web application in it, you know, to a lesser or greater extent, depending on your definition of what a web application is, then we ought to consider how to better conceptualize these things. And I think prototyping is a good potential route. So there you go. You're looking unbelieving again.
I don't know. This is hard, isn't it? It depends what you mean by web app.
Well, I mean, I would, But even like today, you know, when you do something like a contact us form, right? You know, now we're using more JavaScript stuff to do things like, you know, validation on it and, you know, pop-up messages and calendar pickers and, all, you know, I want to preview my comic before it's submitted and all that kind of stuff. Mm. Very hard to wireframe all of that. Not impossible, but you end up with lots of wireframes for a single form.
Unless you use something like PowerPoint, which can rebuild that.
It can do, but again, it's...
Fiddly.
Yeah. And you figure, well, you might as well do a rough and ready thing in JavaScript.
I think if the developers and the IA people and the designers all work together, i.e. it's the same company,
yeah,
then it's possibly the right way to go. I'm currently talking about wireframing with one of our clients, and we're not going to be doing... We might be doing the design, but we won't be doing the development work.
Oh, that's a bit different.
So there's no way in the world we can start utilising... basically their content management system as a prototype. But what we're probably going to do is use ours.
Yeah.
So in a way, we are kind of building a prototype that we'll throw away.
Yeah, that's a prototype that's being chucked out. But yeah, I know.
It's there to be used. So
I mean, with any of these things, you know, it's like going back to the art direction thing we were talking about a minute ago. It's all about context, isn't it?
Exactly.
And, you know... It's just another option. It's another tool in your arsenal.
I do think...
And it's been around... Prototyping's been around for a long time, but people have often dismissed it as being overly expensive, and it's not always the case. I think that's the key.
I mean, I think if what you're doing is building a kind of flat HTML wireframe, and you're putting in lots of bits of JavaScript to try and make... to demonstrate particular bits of functionality, then probably you may as well just build it.
Yeah.
And so, yes, to an extent, I do agree with this, but it depends.
It depends. Yeah. All context. Right, that's the news done. Let's move on to our feature.
Bugworld.com.
Okay, so we talked a lot on the show before about our experiences of working for an external agency like Headscape. And although a lot of the advice we give is very generic, we haven't really looked in any great depth before about what it's like to be an in-house designer and the kind of experiences that they have, you know. And I think in many ways, I've got a lot of sympathy for in-house designers and developers. It can be quite a thankless and isolating job, depending on the size of your team. And so I thought I'd look at some ways, maybe how you could make your life easier as an in-house designer or developer. Now, I last worked as an in-house designer over 8 years ago. So I don't think I can really comment on the subject anymore. So I've therefore enlisted the help of the BOAG World Forum, and I've dug out various emails that I've been sent over the last couple of years, and I've also picked the brain of Paul, who's our researcher, and Ryan, who's our producer, because both of them are in-house developers. And so I've compiled a quick kind of top 10 tips for improving the lot of the in-house staff. So no particular order. Here we go. Number
one. Eyes down, looking.
Eyes down, yes. we've turned into bingo. Right, perhaps we'll do a bingo podcast. That'd be much more exciting.
How would that work, then?
I'm full of great ideas today. Don't bother me with the details. It's just the concept.
Next week's going to be the bingo podcast.
It's blue sky thinking.
I actually used the term blue sky thinking
you
later
didn't.
On.
You
didn't. I did.
You should be ashamed of yourself. Anyway, number one. Okay. Coding with others in mind. The general consensus seems to be that in-house code, as an in-house coder, it's much more important to consider the next guy who comes along. Whether you're working as part of a team or as a lone developer, sooner or later somebody's going to have to pick up your code and work with it. Two techniques have been suggested for coding with others in mind. The first was to carefully comment all your code and produce it. You know, in a way that it's clearly marked up about what's happening, and also to produce supporting documentation as well. The second is to have a library of reusable code so that all work that's produced is produced using consistent markup. This way you can easily pass it around the team or onto the next person. Personally, I believe that this is good practice whether you're an in-house designer or not, to be honest. Certainly, Headscape uses an extensive library of HTML, CSS, and JavaScript snippets. Somebody else suggested in the comments and when I posted this blog that it's good practice to do as well, because when you leave the company, what can sometimes happen is the next person comes along, doesn't understand what you've done, and starts bad-mouthing you. And actually, there was one person who said that she actually had trouble getting a reference from her old employer because the new developer had bad-mouthed her. So, not particularly good. Anyway, so, of course, if you're working alone, then, you know, having a library of snippets is less pressing. However, our next problem is a bigger concern to you, which is that many in-house designers and developers do work in isolation by themselves. There are relatively few organisations that can afford a web team, and working alone does have obvious drawbacks. First, it's hard to keep up to date with new approaches because you haven't got other people to learn from. It's also easy to get stuck in a rut using the same old techniques. And in web design, stagnation can be both dangerous for your career, but also for the evolution of the site that you're supporting. Second, let's face it, it can be lonely. Even though you have other people with whom you work, they cannot share your full of sympathy. They cannot share your experiences as a web developer. They can't moan about shared problems or geek out on code or typography. Marcus has just walked off.
I'm leaving you alone.
Honestly. The solution is something we've spoken about a lot before. Make contacts within the industry, both online and off. Use tools like forums, Twitter, and mailing lists. Offline, look to go to meetups and conferences and that kind of stuff. If there's nothing in your area, then don't let that put you off. Set something up. If somewhere as backward as Dorset can have a web design meetup, which, by the way, I went to it. It was great. Went to a web design meetup.
You must have been like King Paul.
No. None of them knew who I was.
I bet they did by the end.
That's harsh. And anyway, nobody can probably hear you. Too far away from your mic. So, yeah, it was really good. So if somewhere as backwards as Dorset can have a web design meetup, there's no reason why your area can't too. Marcus, it is hugely off-putting having you wandering around doing your dishes and getting yourself drink and stuff. Get your ass back in here. Anyway, moving on while he totally ignores me. The feeling of isolation can be exasperated because management often fails to get what you're trying to do. Oh, flapjacks. Ah, now that's really annoying. You put flapjacks in front of me that you can eat because you don't say as much on the podcast. Am I going to get a chance to? I barely can get a chance to take a drink.
They're fairly actually chewy guys.
Ah, so this could be a bad idea then.
I recommend you don't eat any.
Okay, then I'll keep these two for later.
Good idea.
Right. Anyway, what were we saying? Oh, yes, demonstration speaks 1,000 words. Right. So the feeling of isolation can be exaggerated because management often fail to get what you're trying to do. And it can be amazingly frustrating when you've got a great idea and you fail to make others see why it's such a good idea. So one solution, going back to what we were talking about earlier, might be to build a proof of concept or prototype. It's often much easier, according to the in-house developers I've spoken to convince management of an idea if they can see it in action. And some people that have kind of fed back for this post have said they even spend their evenings producing prototypes, as they're not given much of an opportunity to do so at work. Now, personally, I can't help but wonder whether you should actually be looking for a job in the evenings rather than doing prototypes if they don't give you time to do that kind of thing at work.
Yeah, but you should only have to do that once or twice.
Yeah.
Because then if you've convinced management of that your worth and you've got great ideas, then you only need to do it once or twice. So.
Yeah, possibly. So anyway, so that's another little tip that came out from my research is do some prototypes and demonstrate research. I made a post on the Bergwald forum and read some emails. Does that count as research?
Yeah.
Sounds good, doesn't it? Okay, number four, one idea that I agree with is that in-house developers should work within the same rigid structures used by an external agency. So too many in-house teams are treated like a free resource that people can turn to whenever they like. And this leads to things like scope creep.
Well, that's right, isn't it?
What?
That's how I treat our designers. And
yes, I know. And it leads to scope creep. And more importantly, the web team being undervalued, you cheeky git.
I don't do that.
You so do.
I don't.
You so do.
Well, I might with quotes.
Actually, I'm probably worse than you.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, good point.
Make it work. It's broken. Fix it. Now. That's Paul talking, by the way.
So what do I mean by rigid structure? Well, I'm talking about things like that if you're an in-house developer, you should have things like statement of work, change control procedures, client sign-off, project milestones, both for yourself and your internal clients, and resource assignment and even budgeting. Now, these techniques will ensure that projects run smoothly, it will limit scope creep, and it projects a kind of professional image to your internal clients, improving their perception of you as a development team. Now, there is also the... I think you should do this no matter how small the job is. For example, you know, even if you're just being asked to change some copy on your website, always confirm what you've been asked to do via email. You know, in effect, that acts as a mini statement of work. It's not a lot of effort, not a lot of overhead to do it, but it just kind of sets boundaries the whole time.
Yeah.
And project...
Wise words, Paul.
Indeed, I'm full of wise words. And project management doesn't need to be onerous in order to be effective. So, of course, the best way of making somebody value your work is to charge them for it, which is the approach that we use. Give us money and we might do some work. There seems to be a general consensus that where possible, internal charging for an in-house developer or designer is a good idea. However, let's face it, often that is outside of your control. So if you are unable to charge clients, I've got an alternative. Now, nobody else has said this. This is my idea. So if it's crap and doesn't work in practice,
it's
you
crap
know who
and doesn't
to blame.
Work, but carry on.
Have you read this
book? Yes.
And you think it won't work? I think it will. I think it will. So one option, right, is to calculate how much you cost the company per hour, right? Only roughly. It doesn't need to be perfect. You know, it can be an approximation. But once you've got that figure, you can start to include it in your statement of work, because your statement of work should say how many hours you're spending on a task. So you list all the tasks that got to be done, associate a time with each of these tasks, and include a cost to the company for each task. Hopefully, this will make internal clients think twice before using up your time. And if you want to further leverage it and really kind of make people think twice, start submitting a monthly report to your manager outlining the work that you have done and the associated cost. And let your internal clients know that you're doing that as an incentive to think twice. Why wouldn't that work?
Because basically you're telling your management how expensive you are. And that actually if they just outsourced this once a month every year, they'd save a hell of a lot of money.
That's quite a good point, actually.
But
actually, I don't think it does show how expensive they are. I think it shows how cheap they are.
Well, yeah.
Depending on how much work there is going. Yeah, well, that's for... Yes. So there we go. There's a caveat we would put on it. If really you shouldn't be working there and you're dossing around all the time, don't do this idea. Mm. Which is, judging by Paul and Ryan, who help out with the podcast, I think probably they shouldn't. Because they seem to have a lot of time to do Boag World stuff in their work
I
hours.
Hope none of their bosses listen
I
to this.
I hope not, otherwise they're totally screwed. I haven't said their surname, so it could be any Paul and Ryan.
Yeah, good, couldn't it?
And I could now pretend that they work at the same place, and then that would throw people. But they don't. So anyway, yes, next one. Another piece of advice that was generally agreed upon is that there is a need to be internally perceived as an expert. Now, how you're perceived is important if you want your opinion to be respected. So avoid being hesitant or negative about ideas because there is a tendency when somebody asks you to do something, right, of going, oh, I'm not sure how I'll do that. So therefore, your reaction turns into, well, I don't think that's a really good idea, or, yeah, I don't know, kind of. And you become quite negative because you're not sure how to implement it. Instead, just say, look, I'll come back to you over that. There's some, I need to do a bit of research, and then I'll, you know, but sounds a great idea, but let me go away and research it. Research your options, and if appropriate, bring in an expert in that field to do that work. Using specialists, which I think a lot of internal developers and designers are worried about calling in specialists because they think that in some way it undermines their authority. In my opinion, rather it demonstrates that you can manage a project even if it's bigger than your personal capabilities, and I think that's a good thing and not a bad.
Yep, I totally agree.
On the subject of negativity, avoid saying no.
No.
Don't be annoying. Many internal web teams are perceived as a barrier to be overcome. And how many times have we heard that be the case? Where marketing people talk negatively about the techies?
Yeah, all the time. It's great. It takes me back to Town Pages when the sales department used to go and talk to you. No, yeah. I'm not doing it.
I know. I always used to say that. I've matured and grown since
neg,
then.
Neg, neg, neg.
So yes, they are seen as a barrier to be overcome. Internal clients often turn to an external agency in an attempt to bypass internal teams entirely. And once you're out of the loop, of course, you lose control entirely. A better tactic than saying no is to say yes. There we go.
Yeah. Profound advice. Fantastic, Paul. Basically, but, this is, it's about you can't avoid internal politics.
No.
You can't just be the designer or the developer sat in your room in the dark doing design and development. You have to play the internal politics game. Otherwise, you will be pushed aside by people who they perceive that you're not cooperating with
them. Yes, exactly.
Simple as that.
So, say yes, and here's the big caveat, but explain the consequences. Once you explain the negative impacts of a suggestion, then follow up quickly by being positive and giving an alternative, right? So, and we do this all the time, or I do this all the time with clients. So, yeah, sure, we can make your logo five times bigger, but it'll mean that, you know, this content is going to be pushed lower in the page, users won't see it, they won't click through, they won't buy, and you'll go out of business. But what we could do is this.
Make it flash.
Yeah. Much better. So there we go. In everything you do, be confident and enthusiastic. Avoid being perceived as a stereotypical geek who sits in the dark and barely utters a word. And ensure that you're likable, because if people like you and see you as a positive person, then they will listen to and respect your opinion. To further enhance your reputation, carrying on the politics theme, make sure you broadcast your successes as widely as possible. If you launch a new subsite or a new feature, ensure you tell as many people internally as possible about it. If the company has an internal newsletter or mailing list, make sure that you write something explaining what you've done and why you've done it in plain English that anybody can understand. Focus on what the project brings to the business rather than how it works or why it was challenging. Offer to run workshops internally about the web or give a mini presentation on web strategy to management. Anything to make you appear proactive and of benefit to the business. So Ryan and Paul, take note of this. You have to appear beneficial to the business. Find a way. Okay. So, I mean, basically, as Marcus has already said, a lot of the points that we've talked about so far relate to company politics. And every organisation has internal politics. And rising above them, as Marcus said, is not a realistic option. You have to get stuck into the politics, really, to be honest.
Yep.
One area where politics becomes particularly important is sign-off. If you're having trouble getting something approved, ask yourself the following questions. Does my internal client really have the power to sign it off? Or is there somebody else pulling the strings behind the scenes? Also, who is influencing the person doing the sign-off? Who's saying this is good or bad or indifferent? And who is that opinionated troublemaker that is slowing the whole process down? Because there is always one, normally me. In many cases, the person who might appear to be the decision-maker isn't really. They're being controlled by management higher up or influenced by a few vocal individuals. If this is the case, you need to speak directly to these people or at least give the client the tools they need to force sign-off through. The final little point that I wanted to raise on this subject, and that came back from the feedback I received, is always have facts to back up your opinion. This is especially important if people within your organisation don't respect your own opinion. Facts and figures are especially good, but if you can't say, well, 75% of our users don't like exploding chickens running across the screen, then if you can't find stats to back that up, then find an expert or preferably multiple experts that say exploding chickens are a bad idea.
Mm-hmm.
So, But if you are quoting a kind of an internationally recognised expert like Steve Krug, although it will carry a lot of weight, remember to explain who Steve Krug is, because there's no reason why your manager or your marketing person is going to know who that individual is. Where an internal client remains unconvinced by an expert opinion, turn to a weight of evidence. Don't quote just one expert, quote 10. The sheer number of people saying the same thing will eventually impress. So there you have it. Some straight forward advice from the BOAG World community. It's just really good. Really good list of things people have come up back with. And I'm going to do this more. I like this approach of asking people in advance. So I've already asked people to provide some feedback on the forum about next week's topic. So that will be good. So there we go. Talking of community involvement, we've got some excellent reviews this week, both of which come from the BOAG World community.
BOAGworld.com.
Okay, so the review section of the show. We're going to do something a little bit different this week. As you know, for the last couple of weeks, we've been running a competition to win some tickets for Deconstruct.
All right. Forgot about that.
Yeah, so there you go. Just in case you don't know what Deconstruct is, it's a one-day conference that happens down in Brighton. It's a really good conference that kind of covers the fundamentals of web design. They've got a different theme running each year. And I highly recommend it. One of the best conferences there are about. And just one day, so it's not overly expensive. It's £125, including a VAT. You can buy tickets now. Tickets are available. They went out yesterday for the first time. They tend to sell out very quickly. So what's the date today for people? 25th, is it?
Yeah.
So it's the 25th today. Get over there as soon as you hear this show, and you can get tickets. Also, you can find out information about when it is. Who's going to be speaking? Some good speakers. Again, Daniel Berker is speaking, and I really like listening to Daniel Berker talk about his experiences at DIG. So the website for more on Deconstruct is 2008.deconstruct.org. So check that out. So what we have is we have our two winners for the show. And basically, both of these guys have submitted reviews. The first is Tevian Jordan. And the second is John McFarlane. So congratulations, you guys. You both submitted brilliant reviews. Don't point at the dog. The dog isn't going to make any noise.
He was doing some real heavy breathing there. He's just come back from a walk. He smells of horse poo.
Oh, nice. So congratulations, you guys. I'm sorry your moment of stardom was ruined by Marcus being silly with his dog. Yeah, so you guys will both be receiving more information about tickets soon, once I get my act together. And for the rest of you, you get to enjoy their brilliant submissions, which won them their tickets. So there are two reviews coming up, one for TextMate, and one is a top five tips for web designers. Listen to them back to back.
Hi, I'm Tyvian Jordan. I am reviewing a program created by someone far smarter than me. I'm going to be looking at TextMate. TextMate is a Mac-only application, though there is a similar editor called eTextEditor for Windows. First impressions of TextMate are that it's pretty sparse. It looks like any other editor. I throw it a PHP file and it colours the text in, just like any other editor would. The colour scheme can be changed, both text and background colours can be altered, which is quite a neat touch. I can even make parts bold, italic and underlined. It does require knowledge of regular expressions, but I can actually add in more rules for what to colour in. I used this to make variables used as array indices to appear differently, something I've wanted to do for some time. Not since I was a toddler, but definitely some time. But enough moaning about how the program itself is both smarter and better than me. I wanted to try some code. I found that if I typed for each inside a PHP block and hit tab, I was presented with an entire for each loop. Closer inspection revealed that there were dozens of snippets and commands for PHP, and dozens more for each of the many languages, and some things that were not languages. With 5 minutes of effort, I had set up TextMate to post my blog posts for me. I am now one step closer to not having to put any effort at all into blogging. It is possible to create your own snippets, and not at all hard either. I now have one to tell me that I'm beautiful, and another to create a PostgreSQL query. I can also write new commands. I can write them in command line script, Python, Ruby, PHP, to name a few. All of the commands are completely open source, so you can see what's already been done and sort of plagiarize that sort of work for your own nefarious means. Except plagiarism's bad, don't ever do it. I can edit columns, I can write new snippets, commands, and even entire languages. I can regex, I can manage projects with a hierarchical file structure. It's like before I was walking, but now I'm on a push bike. I can't make use of the ability to run down pedestrians until I learn how to balance and pedal. Okay, the running down pedestrians was a bad example, but anybody that is still listening and not calling the police must have understood it, so I'll continue. There's nothing I can't do in TextMate. I just need to look at the extensive online manual to learn it. And there, I think, is its biggest failing. TextMate is a really lovely program to use, but it's so complicated. Coda, as a contrast, is a more intuitive application, but it is to TextMate as a spade is to a chainsaw. That is, it meant for a different problem and with fewer moving parts, but also with the ability to dig holes. No, wait, I'm sorry, my mind wandered. What I meant to say is that TextMate is great for dealing with code, but not so much for the design, which is what apps such as Coda excel at. I've now been using TextMate for 10 months, and I still think there is potential to unlock, though that could be because I'm a thickie. I suppose I should wrap this up by saying that I would hardly recommend anybody thinking about writing lots of code to give TextMate a good look. It takes a lot of time to get a lot out of it, but there really is a lot to get out of it. Thank you very much for listening. I hope this was at least semi-informative.
Hi, I'm John McFarlane, and this is the first ever review brought to you live from my living room. Today I'm reviewing a post that's been submitted on the boagworld.com forum. The title is Top 5 Tips for New Web Designers. I've been reading through the replies and have put together my top 5 top tips. In at number 5, submitted by Rich Quick, allow time and money for personal development. Read blogs, buy books, attend conferences, experiment and learn new techniques and technologies. In at number 4, posted by JFen, surround yourself with designers, whether they're colleagues, real-world contacts, online contacts, forums, podcasts. The more you talk about design, the more you learn. And I'd like to add to that, email a few web designers for advice and let them know your experiences. In at number 3, posted by some guy called Paul Boag, develop with the latest best practices. Ensure you separate content, design and behavior. Make sure everything you build uses progressive enhancements. In at number 2, another one by Paul Boag, but it's an obvious one, but something that can't be put across more clearly. Know HTML, CMS and JavaScript inside out. You need to know the core technologies that underpin the web back to front. I'd like to add to this point, the basics of HTML and CMS are easily learnt, but don't be fooled into thinking you know enough. You really need to know these subjects to an advanced level. This will benefit you when you're implementing the latest best practices. And that brings me on to my number one tip, and that is love your job. I think if you love this industry, have a passion for web design, I think those qualities will guide you to achieve your goals. So enjoy your development and don't rush yourself too much. Take the time to develop the right way, build contacts and friends, and embrace the industry as a whole. Well, that about wraps up this week's review. I hope you've enjoyed the first ever review show live from my living room. Thank you and goodbye.
Boagworld.com.
So our first listener comment for the day is from Kirk, which is very exciting. I think that's exciting. It's like Star Trek.
Well, Captain Kirk.
Captain Kirk.
I think it's his first name, not his last name.
Kirk Henry. Yeah, so you're a bit of a disappointment, Kirk Henry. If it's Henry Kirk, that'd be cooler. So, yes, Kirk writes, I'm not sure this is... I've lost it now.
Come on.
I'm not sure whether this is a question or not. I'm a creative director for a development shop with some very large Fortune 500 companies, and a problem I've always come across is difficulty in the estimating process. We use Excel documents and have some standard hours for comps, but have to do some custom estimation for things like multimedia projects, etc. My estimates are always pretty decent, but I want to know what you guys use or what software you would recommend. I've been listening on iTunes from the start and love the show. So there we go. Go on.
That's kind of my area. So
yeah, you're in charge of this.
I shall talk about this.
I'm going to eat flapjack very loudly into the microphone.
Good idea. Okay. That's not very nice, actually.
It's not.
No, okay. I wouldn't do that.
I'd go further back.
Yeah, that's okay. You're right there. Okay, this is probably the most important subject that we, and I mean everyone within the web community, doesn't talk about. Why is this? I think it's because basically it's difficult to pin down a method of reliably estimating a project, and more so that we're all guilty of underestimating time and again.
So basically we're all chancing it, and none of us are actually willing to admit that we make up as we go along.
Well, the bottom line is that an estimation is a guess, and but I'll come on to that in a minute. Before I get on to Kirk's question, the first thing I wanted to talk about is... ask yourself, how serious is this project that I'm being asked to estimate?
Mm-hmm.
I feel that I've got a bit of a sixth sense, and it's not sixth sense, I've just been doing it for a long time, for requests like the following. So these are the kind of requests that you often receive.
this first one, you only need the first four words of this sentence to know that it's a waste of time.
We have this idea.
Yeah.
But have no idea how much it will cost. And we want you to do all the research work involved in scoping it. Obviously, this isn't exactly what they're saying, but this is if you read between the lines, basically, yeah, we've got this great idea, and can you give us a quote? And what they actually mean is, can you put all the thought into what the tasks are that are going to make up that the estimate that you're going to provide with them? And of course, they won't pay for this process, this research process, and there's no way that they'll pay sensible money for the work once they know what it is. Basically, this is your new idea.
Yeah.
People, I've got this great idea for a new company. I currently work for someone else, but this is going to make me multi-billions.
Yeah. And then normally, sooner or later, it's followed up with the classic line of, well, we don't have a lot of money, but would you like to go in with us on it?
At least that's a little bit more honest, because then you can just say no. Bye. Whereas these ones, they, you know, it's all very, yes, we've got funding and blah, blah, blah.
Oh, I know, yeah.
But they haven't. So, yeah, that's just one example of when you're being asked, requested an estimation or a quote, if you like. Another one is, we have a supplier that we want to work with, but my boss says I need a couple of other quotes.
Yeah.
Just try and kind of know. They usually need them really quickly.
Yeah.
I need it by tomorrow lunchtime. And it's because they're sussed out what they want, but I have to do this. A final one is, and this is where I use the term blue sky thinking. Us guys in sales and marketing have been doing some blue sky thinking and want a quote to redevelop Google.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, if it comes through and you're thinking, wow, that's a massive, massive project, that'll take us a year and a half to do that off the top of my head, chances are it's just complete rubbish. But you get the idea, these are all time wasters, and you need to deal with these requests quickly. And this is how I do it. If I decide that I am actually going to, sometimes I'll just politely say no thank you, because it's obvious. But if you're thinking, well, I ought to respond. What I do is have a chat with whichever department head would do this work if it ever materialised, which can often be more than one person, and get them to give you a really wide ballpark figure. So we're talking chat over the phone, 2 or 3 minutes. This is the outline. What do you reckon?
Yeah.
And that's it. Add in project management and some contingency, and then send them an email with, this is a very wide ballpark based on my complete, utter non-knowledge of your project.
Yeah.
99 out of 100 won't even bother to get back to you.
Mm.
Some will, and basically what they're doing is trying to push. Can you break that down for me a little bit? And what they're trying to do is just trying to get you to scope it for free again. So say no. But anyway, I've ranted long enough about time wasters, so back to Kirk's question. First question, relating to kind of real estimations, is, do you know what the budget is? And if yes, then what you're doing is you're looking to fit a particular scope into a set amount of effort. And can you do it? Will the client be happy with the scope that fits their budget? And do they understand what the scope is? Because what often happens is that you have to reduce that scope to fit it within their budget, or you should do, if you shouldn't be trying to fit it the other way around. Don't get creative with your effort allocations just to fit in with the budget. Either ask for more up front or walk away. Mm-hmm. I've said that before. I haven't said it for a while, though, have I?
No.
Walk away. If you don't know the budget, then you're looking to scope a project from scratch. If it's a really big project, then ideally you should be being paid to do that work, because it's a lot of work. You're researching. It's not just sort of a sort of back of an envelope stuff. You're looking to scope a project properly. It takes days, and it can take even longer than that. I've lost my thread. Break down the project into rough task areas. It's likely that you'll have done other projects that include similar tasks, so you'll know efforts on these. Now, and this is the only time when we should get scientific, and it's not guessing. You need to look back and ask yourself if you got it right last time. Yeah. So even though if you've got, this is my new project that I've got to provide a quote for or an estimate for, and you've broken it down into the major tasks, and you think, well, yeah, we've done that before, this particular part of it, and this is what we quoted last time. Well, just ask yourself, is that exactly what it cost, or mm-hmm. should you be up or down? Nearly always should be up. For the new task, then break it down even further, so that you're going to find other, smaller tasks within subtasks within that main task that you've done before, so you can then put a figure to it. But for the really new stuff, which is often functionality, then you need to talk to an expert, either a designer or a developer or an information architect, whoever it is, and get them to think the task through. What they're providing you with is an informed guess, because they haven't done that piece of work. They're thinking, right, okay, to do that, I'll have to do this, 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 and this, and this. And they're giving you. And it's a guess. And because people are guessing, it's really important to overestimate fixed price projects.
Yeah.
This is the cost to the client of having a fixed price, basically, because you don't really know. Mm. So you've got to think, well, this is what I think it is, and then add a bit on. Don't forget to charge for meetings. If three people are attending, then charge for three people.
Mm-hmm.
And that can get really quite expensive.
Mm.
Project management is notoriously undercharged. We kind of have a 15 to 20% rule, and that's probably light. But the golden rule of estimating is, don't be tempted to lower your probably already too low price just to win the work. Be prepared to walk away.
Indeed.
One final point. As far as tools to help with estimating go, MS Project or similar is great for separating tasks out, linking resources to those tasks, and giving you a good idea of how long things will take. So, but I mean, how often do we actually do that?
Not that often.
Not that often. Do use Project to create Gantt charts, but to actually put all the different effort, the different resources, i.e. the different people, designer, yeah. developer, and link the two together, often takes longer than it's actually worth doing. But I tend to find that, yeah, as I'm saying here, it's over the top and at quote stage, and tend to stick with Excel, because that separates projects out, separate tasks out really well.
Cool. Good stuff. Do you want to read the next question then, which is from Adrian?
Yes, I was enjoying having a ramble there.
It was a good ramble.
Which I was having a lovely, lovely ramble. Okay, right.
By the way, you can stop when it says, I appreciate the logic. That's me. Because I always, that's the trouble with reading questions. It's the way I blame Ryan and the way he formats them. He doesn't indent the questions or anything. So yeah. You could just keep
no italics.
Lot.
No, nothing.
Inconsiderate bastard.
And you said it. Said he wasn't very busy. Ryan who? dear. Anyway, right. Hey guys, long time listener from the States. Maybe I should be doing the accent. Maybe not.
Maybe not.
I've been working on a new personal site lately, and I've become fixated on the idea of using newspaper-style columns. Since you two seem to know a thing or two about usability...
So, you two? What, the two of us? What do you know?
Loads more than you. I'd figure I'd ask for your thoughts. It seems like most people view them as a print concept that doesn't translate well online, but seeing as most screens these days are widescreen and vertical space is taken up by menu bars, docs and browser extensions, going horizontal strikes me as a logical solution.
And I appreciate his logic. You know, it's true that computers are, you know, many more widescreen these days. Laptops tend to be widescreen, monitors you buy tend to be widescreen, and that vertical space as a result is at a greater premium than horizontal. However, I think you need to think really carefully before employing newspaper-style columns, to be honest. I think there's two concerns that I've got. The first is a usability concern, and the second one is a technical concern. So let's quickly look at them. As you point out, people reference usability as their primary reason against newspaper columns. In a newspaper, copy runs down across several columns, and your eye darts from the bottom of one column to the top of the another, no problem. This is acceptable because users can view the entire newspaper in a single glance. There's no such thing as scroll bars, basically.
Yeah.
On the web, obviously, things are different. You are unable to predict the height available in a browser window. And so, because you don't know what the height is, you're almost certainly going to have to scroll sooner or later. And this means that you scroll all the way down as you read one column. You get to the bottom and then have to scroll all the way back up to the top to start reading the next column.
That doesn't work.
Which doesn't work. And it is far less of a pleasurable reading experience. And it's also, that's not the only thing. You also need to consider width that is available to you as well as height. You know, as you say, newspaper-style columns work well at high resolution on widescreen monitors. In theory, they could do.
Hmm.
However, you know, on anything less than that, the story becomes, you know, basically unreadable as the columns get narrower and narrower and the line lengths get shorter and shorter. The alternative, I guess, is to have both horizontal and vertical scrolling. But as we all know, that's the ultimate usability no-no. So avoid that at all costs. So that's my kind of usability problems with it.
Mm-hmm.
But also, there is technical considerations here to take into account as well. How will the story be split over those multiple columns? Currently, this can't be done very easily with CSS, although this may appear in CSS 3. One option, I guess, would be to manually lay out each block of text, you know, by hand. However, this isn't going to be practical for anything more than the most static of sites. The only option, really, is some form of server-side code. However, even this really isn't without its problems. There's quite a lot of detail that you need to think into this. Consideration needs to be given to inline elements, such as if there's an image in the block of text. You know, what happens if that image comes at the end of a column? Does it get pushed to the top of the next column, or does it extend the column you're currently in? What about things like quotations, if you're quoting somebody? Obviously, a proper good designer indents your quotations in some way or makes them italics so you can see they're different from the rest of the copy, Ryan. but also with columns, there's the problem of, well, does that quotation get split? Or does it move in its entirety to the next column? You know, how does that work? So it's not that you can't do these things. It's just that there's a lot of thought that needs to be given into them. You know, what happens, for example, when you scale text? Or if you have an image that's larger than the width of a column? All of these things need thinking about. You know, they can be overcome. But to be honest, you know, considering the serious usability concerns and the technical problems as well, to be honest, I think don't bother.
No.
No. I could have just said no, couldn't
yeah.
I?
Yeah, bad idea. Don't do it.
Bad idea. Don't do it. So there we go. That's today's show. Obviously, we obviously have to endure Marcus's joke. Do you have a joke today?
Yeah, and it's a pretty silly one.
It's a silly one. Who's it been sent in
this
by?
This is from Ian Lasky.
Oh, Ian.
I'm sort of building them up, but this one kind of won the silliest prize, so I thought I'd go for that one first. A car tolling down a country road sputtered to a complete stop near a field filled with cows. Cow joke, appropriate.
For our website, yeah. Okay. Looks nice.
The driver, getting out to see what was the matter, noticed a cow looking at him. "I believe it's your radiator," said the cow. The startled man ran to the nearest farmhouse and knocked on the door. "A cow just gave me advice about my car," he shouted. "Did the cow have big black spots on it?" the farmer asked. "Yes, it did."
Really, that doesn't narrow it down much in cow
terms.
Fairly,
but yeah. Big black spots, right. All right, okay. "Well, that's Ethel," said the farmer. "Don't pay any attention to her. She doesn't know a thing about cars."
Yeah. Okay, Ian, thanks for the contribution, but need to improve your game a little bit, mate. That, or it was Marcus's bad. That was terrible. That was really terrible. That was possibly the worst joke.
I've done some good jokes lately, so it's about time I did a rubbish one.
That was...
Okay.
Very rubbish. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Because it's because, you know, he thought the cow...
Yeah, I understand. Yes.
And
it still wasn't funny.
And it was,
no, I'm sorry.
Okay. Sure.
So don't forget to check out the show notes at boegworld.com/podcast/123. Also, the forum. It's always a good place to hang out. boegworld.com/forum. And we want your suggestions and ideas for the show, which you can do at boegworld.com. Sorry, that was wrong. boegworld.uservoice.com. Thank you very much. Marcus, who a different Marcus, who created that application.
And yes, it wasn't me.
No, definitely wasn't Marcus. So that wraps up this week. Thank you very much for listening, and we will talk to you again next week, I hope. And maybe even see each other.
You never know. Bye.
Hello, world of Boeing.
It's like being on David Letterman.
Boag World is produced by headscape.co.uk, supported by getsignoff.com, and presented by Paul Boag and Marcus Lillington. Technical support is provided by Anna Debenham of mayburn.co.uk, a researcher is Paul Stanton of coffeepower.co.uk, and the show's producer is Ryan Taylor of havockinspired.co.uk. To contribute to the show, visit boagworld.com/contact, call 020-8133-5122 or join our forum at boagworld.com/forum.